Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, March 26, 2006, here in Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign on an absolutely lovely spring or early spring Sunday afternoon. Today we're going to be talking about a subject we've had discussions on Media Matters about in the past, oftentimes with one of our guests who's in studio with us today, that being Sasha Meinrath. Sasha Meinrath is the project co-coordinator of the Champaign-Urbana Community Wireless Network, QWIN. Sasha is also known nationally for his expertise in community wireless internet, has testified and provided expertise in Washington to the FCC, to industry and public officials all across this country, and I'm proud to say Sasha Meinrath is a PhD student in the Institute of Communications Research, where I teach here at the University of Illinois, so that connection should be known. Sasha, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bob.
Great to have you here. Also joining us on the phone from Washington, D.C., is Harold Feld. Harold Feld is a name that many of you might not be familiar with, which is unfortunate because if you were to make a list of the legal and technical experts on the core policy issues surrounding the internet and media in general, no list would be credible unless his name was at the very top. Harold Feld is the Senior Vice President of the Media Access Project in Washington, D.C., and it's our honor to have him join us today. Harold, are you there?
I'm here. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And today, of course, as I said at the outset, we're talking about primarily community wireless networks, community internet, this rapidly developing, very exciting new system of internet deployment and access for the people of this country. And to sort of take up this issue in a more concrete manner, there will be a huge conference coming up 1 week from now in St. Louis, just outside of St. Louis in St. Charles, Missouri, which is going to be the National Summit for Community Wireless Networks, which both Harold will keynote at. I'll have the privilege of being there myself. And Sasha has been one of the lead organizers with QWIN on this event. So we want to let people know about that event. And but before we talk about that event, let's start with you, Sasha. You know, a lot of our listeners are, you know, this is already, you know, they're probably already like freaking out at sort of the technical nature of some of the terms we're using, wireless and stuff. What is community wireless? How does that relate to the internet? Why is this such a big deal? Just sort of some of the basics for people maybe not familiar with this at all.
Sure. Well, if you think about the internet, it's really a collection of different networks that are all connected together. So it allows for the transfer of data and information, of production and dissemination of media between different wired computers. And what community wireless really is sort of the next logical step. Instead of saying, oh, we're just going to wire computers together, we can actually wireless different computers and other devices, right? Because obviously you're not going to walk around with a, you know, an extension cord sticking out of your laptop. It allows us to be mobile and roam around while still being able to access all of the information that's available on the internet. Even more than that, it provides an opportunity for all of a sudden to have huge numbers of local media production, dissemination, access within this local network, within this community network. So you can imagine the same way that, say, community radio or public television allows you to provide media to the local community. This really democratizes it, creates a participatory medium where anyone can produce media, anyone can distribute it, anyone can access it, again, without wires and without a lot of the necessary expense of building that wireline infrastructure.
Well, Harold Feld, if we were to have this sort of community wireless internet system Sasha is just talking about, what happens to the phone companies and the cable companies who are the primary means most Americans get internet access in their homes today or in businesses?
Well, you know, I always like to say there is going to be a role for large companies in providing these services no matter what happens. And there are a lot of people who want the services that these big companies are going to provide, the hand-holding, the 24/7 tech support, certain levels of quality of service and security. So the goal of this is never to run Verizon or Comcast or any of these guys out of business. What I always say is they just have to learn how to work for a living like everybody else has to. right now, these companies are sitting in a very nice place. In a lot of places, they're the only broadband facilities provider. Sometimes they allow people to resell it, but now that that's been deregulated, I think we'll see that less and less, and the terms under which people will resell it will be less and less competitive. Sometimes it's just the phone company versus the cable company, and when you have two companies, one against the other, what's called a duopoly, you don't get a lot of real competition because they're pretty much different flavors of the same thing, and they know what each other is offering, and neither one of them is going to, you know, push too hard to try to capture customers by dramatically slashing prices, except maybe at the kind of initial competition stage, as we're seeing now in some places. So what this really does is it creates a new competitor. It forces these big companies that are looking forward to using their market power sometimes to extract payments from third parties. You know, there's a lot of talk now about how, you know, the head of AT&T, Ed Whitaker, has said, well, if Google wants to get to customers through our pipes, they're going to have to pay. Well, if there's a competing community service that will provide that through which, you know, you can get to Google and Google doesn't have to pay, then the folks like AT&T and whoever your local cable providers are not going to be able to just force companies to pay for access to the customers, because if that happens, then people will switch their community service. So what this really does is, number one, it introduces competition where there isn't competition. And number two, it puts control of certain services back in the hands of the local community, so that it will be a much more flexible service. It'll be a lot more customizable to community needs. And I think that's really where we would see, you know, huge improvements over what's available now.
Sasha Meinrath, so these are going to be locally run, community-based, oftentimes wireless internet services. I mean, can they possibly provide the same caliber of service one would get from a big telephone or big cable company with all their sort of millions of dollars of engineers and big wires?
Yeah, often they can. And the reason why they can is because the business model is quite different. So it takes advantage of a lot of efficiencies that existing infrastructure and service providers don't have. So whether you're looking at, you know, the massive redundant overbuilding of wireline infrastructure and the attendant sunk costs in the late 90s, right, that in some ways led to the bust of which WorldCom and Enron are only the tip of the iceberg.
Well, I can hear radio sets going off all over the country on that last sentence, just so people know what you're talking about. In the late 90s, the big telecommunication companies and cable companies spent a lot of money laying down wire so they could set up internet access to businesses and homes around the country.
That's right.
And they vastly overbuilt. So only a small percentage of that wire capacity is actually being used now.
That's right. So Malik Ahm wrote a book about this called Broad Bandits, where he talks about an overbuild of $750 billion. And that's all sunk costs that these companies have laid out already that they then have to recoup. And the only way you can do that is really to charge customers for that overbuilding. And so now what we're seeing are these new technologies, wireless technologies, right, that can lay on some ways on top of that wireline infrastructure and can provide huge efficiencies for local communities, because you don't have to then, you know, pay for the per person access to that wireline. You can buy bandwidth in bulk and share it a lot across a community. Now, anyone that's ever gone to, you know, Costco understands what happens when you buy things in bulk. The per unit cost drops to the floor. And that's exactly true of broadband connectivity as well. And so in some ways, what a lot of the service providers, the telecom incumbents, are fearful of is this idea that you can't then extract from local communities the same monthly per capita price to, again, recoup this loss of this bad business decision in the late 90s.
Now, Sasha Meinrath, who is the project co-coordinator of Champaign-Urbana Community Wireless Network, QIN, one of the great experts on community internet in the United States today, our guest today, Media Matters. Let me follow up with that and ask you about whether this exists anywhere. We know we've, you know, any community in this country, pretty much, you can either get the phone company or cable company will charge you 20, 30, 40, 50 bucks a month to get broadband access in your home or at your business at a different rate.
So-called broadband
access. So-called broadband access. Is this alternative model of community internet exist? I mean, are these government-run things? Are these cooperatives? Are these business-run? I mean, who's – I'm confused because I see ads on TV from Verizon, these people, about their wireless systems. What are we talking about here, and who's doing it?
Right. Well, the good news is that there's a diversity of different business models out there, and there's now over 300 different communities around the country. They're either rolling this out or have built community internet projects. So there's it actually is happening all over the place.
Any here in Illinois?
Yes, there's Aurora, RockNet is doing some stuff. Homer, the city of Homer, is looking into some stuff. City of Chicago has just announced that they're going to be wirelessly in that area. And here, even more locally in Urbana, the city is now rolling out wireless in the downtown area.
And what you mean by rolling out is that that means if you've got a computer and you're in downtown Urbana, you don't have to get anyone's permission. You just automatically get it?
Yes. So it would be free broadband access in downtown Urbana to start with and then branching out from there.
Who pays the cost of this if you have it in a city like Urbana? I mean, is it some good tooth fairy comes along? And
right. So there's a lot of different models for paying for this. Right now what happened is a year ago the city of Urbana decided to explore the possibility of deploying these technologies and so allocated some budget funding. We're talking about $18,600 over a two-year period, which is in the city of Urbana's budget almost nothing, in order to explore what the technologies are and what would be required to roll this out and provide free broadband access in the downtown region and eventually to spread that to interested community members around the city. And what we're seeing is that many of these networks can be built for pennies on the dollar compared to the hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars that people are spending on sort of either proprietary wireless systems or on fiber systems. But I do want to also point out, even in fiber, alternative business models create huge cost savings for consumers. Mm-hmm. So in Utah, there's a coalition of 14 different cities and towns that have created something called the Utopia Project, which is a fiber system, so the same fiber that, say, AT&T has built. Mm-hmm. But instead of providing service of maybe a megabit or a couple megabits, you know, of throughput, they're providing 10 to 15 megabits both up to upload information to the internet and down to download information.
So the quality of the system is actually higher than what either the cable or phone companies are personally offering.
Much higher. But here's where it gets interesting. So the only difference is that the cities own the fiber infrastructure, and then they go to groups like AT&T, right, and say, would you like to provide service? And AT&T says, yes, absolutely. And so for the same $40 that right now you'd pay in Urbana or in central Illinois for a really tiny amount of bandwidth, you get 10 to 15 megabits from the exact same provider. Mm-hmm. The only difference is that the community owns the infrastructure. And instead of trying to maximize profit and extract resources from that local community, they say, let's make it break even. And so we'll keep all of that extra resources. We'll provide the best possible service for the price that allows this project to continue. And that's a very different mentality.
We're talking to Sasha Meinrath and Harold Feld today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live on WILL AM 580. We're talking about the community wireless network revolution going on in the United States. 300 communities are now in the process of launching these systems of broadband access for entire communities that's taking place. There's going to be a major conference on this 1 week from today just in St. Charles, Missouri, just outside of St. Louis, March 31st to April 2nd, Lindenwood University. And Sasha Meinrath is involved in organizing it. Harold Feld is one of the plenary speakers. I will be there, too, on the same panel with Harold, at least one of Harold's panels. And if people want to learn more about this conference, Sasha, where would they go?
You can point your web browser to wirelesssummit.org.
Wirelesssummit.org. Can't beat that. Nice and simple. And I think there's still space available for people who want to come.
Yes.
Not a problem. If you'd like to call in with questions for Sasha Meinrath or Harold Feld, our number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Harold Feld, when I was listening to you speak earlier and then Sasha just now, you know, I think you can make a pretty compelling argument that community wireless networks make a lot of sense for just about everyone. They make sense for the business community because they have lower costs and they have access to use these networks as much as anyone else. They make sense for the average citizen, especially for the sort of people who wouldn't be favored by the phone companies and cable companies. But two constituencies strike me as being immediately threatened by this and probably not especially excited by it, and the ones you referred to earlier, the telecommunications companies, the phone companies, and the cable companies. What has been their response so far to community wireless networks, and what does this mean for the possibility of these being delayed or even stopped in their tracks?
Well, it's kind of funny because these companies, I like to say recently, have been going through the five stages of dealing with a challenge. I mean,
I thought it was 12 stages.
Well, however many stages. I mean, the first is
I have to get one of those Wayne Dyer books that PBS is always touting.
But the initial reaction of a lot of these companies was like, oh, no, this would be awful. And besides, first there was kind of a denial. These guys aren't really going to make a go of it anyway. Then there was, you know, the anger stage. We're not going to let these guys, you know, compete with us. And a lot of these companies have tried to get the state governments or the federal government to pass laws that would prevent communities from investing in these kind of networks. Last year, there was a real effort, mostly by the phone companies, kind of quietly helped by the cable companies. The phone companies have been kind of the loudest and most angry on this, to make it illegal in states for local governments or state governments to try to have any kind of local broadband initiatives, or to load it down with so many reports and limitations as to make it effectively impossible. There were 14 states where that was tried in 2005, and the telcos only won in one state, Nebraska, because that was kind of interesting. That was where folks have been very involved in trying to fight this on the grassroots level and on the national level. In Nebraska, the local power companies thought they had cut a deal, and they told the people who have been very successfully campaigning against these laws in other states to go home because things were settled. And then in the last week of the state legislature, they got rolled by the phone companies, and now they have a very bad law in Nebraska.
Here, if I can just interrupt for 1 second so I can make sense of this. In every state except Nebraska where the phone companies or cable companies have tried to make it illegal for local communities to set up their own wireless networks, they've been defeated.
That's right.
I mean basically these things don't stand up to any popular – don't have any popular support.
Well, that happened in 2005. But unfortunately, before that, you had a lot of state laws that were passed, I think in 14 or 15 states that did. And we had actually one here in Illinois that attempted to make it illegal to mm-hmm. build these networks. So you have this legacy before the general populace sort of realized, wait a second, this is a really bad idea for me, both in terms of my pocketbook and what I can do with the internet. Before that happened, there was a lot of these sort of secret deals built into these state laws, amendments.
These phone companies, traditionally, they floss their teeth with the politicians' underpants of these state houses, don't they? I mean, they always get their way.
Yeah, I mean, this is Harold again here. You know, the problem we've always had in this has been that, particularly in state legislatures, the phone companies and the cable companies are very well connected with the right legislators and the right committees, and you try to talk to people about telecom policy and their eyes glaze over. I've never been to a cocktail party where I've walked up to someone and said, "Hi, I'm in telecom policy," and they were like, "Ooh, that's so exciting, tell me more." So they, until the spotlight went on in Pennsylvania, because in Pennsylvania in 2004, there was a shot heard round the world kind of event. The city of Philadelphia in the summer of 2004 announced that they were going to create a municipal wireless network that would cover all of Philadelphia in a broadband wireless cloud. And then almost in response to this, Verizon, which was the incumbent telephone company in Pennsylvania, got the state legislature at the end of its session in the fall to pass a law that would make it illegal for Philadelphia or any other local government to do any kind of local broadband project unless that local government first asked any private enterprise in the area if they wanted to do it first, and only if they got turned down by the local telephone company and the local cable company could the local government go ahead with a project of its own, and they had to wait 16 months for a response. I mean, it was very bad bill, and that just caused a huge outcry, first in Pennsylvania, where they cut a deal to save the Philadelphia system, but left the other systems out in the cold. Well, anybody that didn't already have a system in place or a plan to do a system by the end of 2005 was going to be stuck with this bad law. But it also really got people interested in this issue. And so in 2005, when we rolled into that, and the telephone companies and the cable companies tried to push these laws again, people were really quite mobilized, and there was very no popular support for it. There were a lot of wherever these laws show up, it's very easy to get the newspapers to editorialize against them because it's so clearly bad for everybody.
Yeah, this is just like purely crony capitalism. It's nothing to do with free enterprise or anything like that.
Exactly. As I always say, I mean, there are two issues here that are very important that people understand. One is your local government needs flexibility to deal with the broadband issue. Broadband has become as essential for business and standard of maintaining a standard of living and education and medicine and all of public safety as electricity, as clean water, all of these things where we want local governments to have the flexibility to do anything from provide the service themselves to leave it to the private sector if that's their choice. But the decision has to be with the local people, you know, working through their local government. The other thing that you know, has come through very clearly in all of this is just a recognition that a lot of this was just doing favors for friends, and people are not very happy with that these days. And this is not a red state issue or a blue state issue. We got these laws stopped in Indiana and Texas, as well as you know, other states that are you know, considered more blue state. It's really just about letting local people make decisions about local business and local money, and not doing favor for your friends who contribute to your PAC.
We're listening to Harold Feld, the Senior Vice President of the Media Access Project, and your website is mediaaccess.org, is that right?
That's right.
Mediaaccess.org, a terrific organization in Washington, a public interest law firm that works on media and communication issues. We're also joined here in the studio by Sasha Meinrath, the project co-coordinator of the Champaign-Urbana Community Wireless Network. We're talking about community wireless revolution going on in this country and in 300 communities around this country today, the policy fights that are necessary to win, to protect it and nurture it, and a big national summit, the second national summit for community wireless networks, which is taking place next weekend in St. Charles, Missouri, March 31st, April 2nd. And if you want to learn about this, and Sasha will be there, Harold will be there, I'll be there. We've got a lot of folks who are going to be there. Mark Cooper from the Consumer Federation of America, who's been a guest on this show. Paul Smith, Center of Neighborhood Technologies. Jim Snyder from the New America Foundation. Is Ben Scott going to be at that?
Yes, he will.
Ben Scott, frequent guest and first producer of Media Matters, will be there as well. And I think our listeners really like what Ben has to say about stuff. And again, if people want to learn about this conference in St. Charles and maybe attend it, where should they go on the web, Sasha?
Yes, well, they should point their browsers to wirelesssummit.org.
Wirelesssummit.org.
I also want to point out, you know, what separates this as a summit from most conferences that are out there is this is really about bringing together the best minds from policy, from implementations in cities and towns around the country, from the hacker community, get them all into the same place to discuss what works, what doesn't work, what do we need to do to protect, you know, a lot of these fantastic projects, and where are we going from here?
Do you have to be a PhD in electrical engineering to understand what these people are going to be talking about?
Absolutely not. I mean,
I wouldn't go if that were necessary.
Yeah, in fact, that was a rhetorical question because I went to the first one of these summits, which was in August 2004, right here. And Harold, you were there.
Oh, yeah.
In Urbana, the first one. And it was an amazing experience. It was just like Sasha described it. People from a lot of different milieus. Some people very technical and brilliant at that. And other people only cared about the social effects of it. What it meant to have a community-run media system or community-run internet networks and the possibilities that meant for building up institutions and at the community level that in so many places in this country today are malnourished with almost no local control or local media to speak of. So, I think that based on the first one, I think it's open to pretty much anyone who cares about these sorts of issues. Our phone lines here at Media Matters, if you want to talk with Harold Feld or Sasha Meinrath, 333-9455, toll free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. Well, two basic issues, one specifically locally here and then nationally, if not global. And my understanding is some nations like South Korea, for instance, have seen the economic benefit in providing broadband access as a public utility for inexpensive or at least very affordable cost, and they see that as a way of benefiting everyone and actually being a driver of economic growth, which doesn't seem to be even a consideration here in this country. And then also, in terms of locally, I just did not want to be, getting my broadband through the local cable company. And I went with Volo here locally. We had a microwave link. And, there was initially quite a bit of an expense just to get the microwave link on my house. And I'm just wondering, now how would, a wireless internet happen here, and what would people need, and how would how much would it cost, and that sort of thing.
Well, thank you. Those are terrific questions. Thank you very much, caller, for raising them. Let's start, if we can, with the international issue. One of the things Sasha Meinrath and Harold Feld, I discovered in doing research for an article I wrote on this subject a few months ago. Was not only that the United States is behind many countries in the world in sort of broadband connectivity for the population, but it's way behind and it's getting a lot worse. I mean, our situation has deteriorated markedly compared to virtually all our peer nations in the world. Mm-hmm. Korea is the country that's held out as the shining example, but this is really across the board. Yeah. And Sasha, can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important not just to look at Korea because, Korea does have a lot of things, like it's got a high population density and it's
small.
It's a small sort of geographic area, but we're being left behind by places like Sweden and Canada, right? Places that have much lower population densities, much larger, in the case of Canada at least, a much larger geographic area to cover, and France. And I mean, we've moved in the last half decade from the premier, the top dog when it comes to broadband provision to 16th place.
Now, what we mean by 16th place, I mean, what is the criteria? We're talking about the percentage of the population of that has access to broadband in their homes?
Exactly, exactly. And so what we're seeing is that we are becoming less and less competitive economically, socially, artistically, culturally, with other countries that have this new medium, which is as vital as roads or education to the sustainability of that and of that country's economy.
Harold Feld, what are these other countries doing that we're not doing, or what are we doing wrong?
Well, I mean, for one thing, in a lot of these countries, there was a decision that was made that we have to have a plan on the national level. And in the United States, we don't have a national plan. Our national plan is to be cheerleaders for the private sector. And to the extent that anybody is putting forward any national plan, it's all about deregulating everything because it's got to be, according to the dominant philosophy here in Washington, D.C., that the only reason companies don't build out and provide us with all of this wonderful broadband is because they're encumbered by all of these old, stupid, bad regulations that worked so well in the past and work well for everybody else in other countries. When you look at examples like Japan, that was really kind of nowhere in 1999-2000 with this, and for an industrial nation was just shockingly behind in terms of its internet and broadband development. You know, they did not sit back and do nothing, nor did they simply deregulate and privatize and hope that that was somehow going to solve their problem. Instead, what they did was to sit down and say, okay, we want to harness competition in a constructive way, and we want to encourage local governments in the area where it's not profitable for the larger companies to deploy, deploy on their own and build fiber rings around their areas, because Japan has a very mixed kind of geography, where up in the northern islands you have a much more sparse population than you do in the main islands and so forth. So they really sat down and thought about how they were going to have a national plan that took into account the differences in their geography, the differences in population, and harness the energy of the private sector in a way that was going to fulfill the goals of the government of promoting ubiquitous and affordable broadband. And in 6 years, they have just done an enormous job.
Well, Harold, what sort of policies could we enact in the United States that would get us, with Japan and Korea and Italy and France and Norway and Sweden and all these other countries have gotten to?
Well, I mean, you know, we have a large and industrious country where people have increasingly recognized the importance of this broadband access as a resource. And the caller who was on mentioned earlier about the need for this as an economic stimulus, not just for tech businesses, but also for run-of-the-mill businesses. Any architect who wants to send big files to potential customers and so forth needs broadband. So the first thing we have to do is, number one, encourage local people to be creative, and that's where, you know, Sasha and Community Wireless comes in. We used to have a program that we funded called the Technological Opportunity Program, TOP, which encouraged the building of these resources on a community level.
Being the federal government?
We being the federal government, yeah, that got defunded. So number one is we should have more faith in local solutions and smaller solutions. We can free up a lot more spectrum for unlicensed sharing. A lot of these wireless broadband systems don't use licenses to use the airwaves in the same way that the cell phone companies do, but they use what's called the unlicensed spectrum. And right now that's in really very small bands. If we were to open up more of the spectrum, which we can do consistent with protecting the licensed services like cell phones and television, and make more of that available to everyone to use, we would see an explosion in broadband in this country, because it would suddenly become a lot easier to build stable wireless systems cheaply. And the last thing we really need to do is to bring back the rules that we had in the dial-up internet, which allowed competitors to use the large central phone network, and I would add the cable network, on a competitive basis and resell that capacity. There is just an enormous amount of energy in the smaller entrepreneurs, in smaller companies that can offer customized services, that these large companies that are focused on the high-end customers simply don't have. And in a lot of places in the United States, the issue isn't deployment of a network. There's a network already there. We have fiber in the ground in a lot of places. The question is just getting people to take the service and making the service affordable for people and making it a service that they want to buy. And for that, we should copy what a number of these other countries have done, which is open access and what's now called net neutrality and used to be called interconnection and common carriage, which means that local competitors can buy at a wholesale rate access to the network. They can have assurance that the traffic that they get from customers will not be treated in a worse way than the traffic that the network they're buying capacity has on its own. And with those kind of changes, we could really see just deployment, and not just deployment, but actual adoption and use of broadband in this country take off in a major way.
I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters Today, live March 26, 2006, on WILL AM 580 here in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest, who you've just been listening to, to Harold Feld, the Senior Vice President of the Media Access Project, talking to us via telephone from Washington, D.C. Also with us in the studio here, Sasha Meinrath, the project co-coordinator of the Champaign-Urbana Community Wireless Network. I think one of the great leaders of the Community Wireless Network movement nationally, one of the great experts on these systems and the benefits they hold for communities. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Sasha and Harold Feld, the number is 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. By the way, 1 week from today, 167 hours, our guest will be Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive magazine, and Matt Rothschild is going to be in town a couple weeks from now giving a talk on the case for impeachment. So Matt will be on the air with us 1 week from today talking about American politics, the case for impeachment, and the state of independent and alternative media in the United States. Let's go back to the phone lines right now if we can. Line 2, Homer, Illinois, thank you for your patience.
Oh, thank you. I've been listening with interest, especially the last part about the network connectivity. And my original question, well, I'm actually calling to you over a voice over internet phone, and is really going to be to that point as far as the connections for small communities. And fortunately, Homer, when I moved here, was wired. Although when I moved from Blacksburg, which had the Blacksburg Electronic Village, in the mid-90s to Champaign in 1997, I was very disappointed that the home of Mosaic didn't have good high-speed access. But that at least changed with the cable company, although you had to pay for it. But my question is, and then the other thing I've started using is a media receiver, in part to hear WILL when the power goes down, is what do we have to worry about the... the restrictions that are going to be put on by the large companies or anyone providing the backbone services so that we can continue to enjoy a lot of the, who could come up with what's the next thing?
Okay.
Although I think you in part addressed that's my concern as much as having access affordably in a small communities, because I know large companies, if there's not a lot of value there, they're not going to want to serve it.
All right, well, thank you very much. You talked about net neutrality, Harold, before, which I think goes to a lot of this, which is not allowing these cable and telephone companies to use their duopolistic power to sort of basically, shake down people who want to use the networks and charge discriminatory pricing based not on the actual cost, but rather on their monopoly power that they get in the marketplace. So that's one issue clearly to deal with. One other issue I'd like to just raise now, there was a column in thenation.com that was carried in Common Dreams by your good friend Jeff Chester, Harold, where he talked about how Google is applying to take over the contract to do a community wireless network in the city of San Francisco. But, he said this isn't necessarily that great of a thing because the price they're going to demand to run this community internet system, wireless system, will be that they can use the whole base, collect all the information on all the users, and then sell specified advertising to reach everyone who uses this network. Is this a real concern that we should be thinking about?
No, I mean, there are a couple of things mixed in there. Let me take one, the net neutrality stuff.
Okay.
That's really critical, and I'm glad.
And that's up before Congress this year. I mean, this is not a hypothetical issue.
This is a big issue, and it's important to understand the history. Until last year, the rule, at least for phone companies, was that they were not allowed to mess with any of the traffic that went over their system, even if they were selling the broadband access. So if you got AT&T DSL or whatever, they were not allowed to mess with the kind of wherever you wanted to go. They had to treat it exactly the same as any site that they owned or any kind of traffic that they held. After a Supreme Court case last year called Brand X involved a company called Brand X Internet Service Provider, that all changed. We lost that case, and the Supreme Court said that the FCC had the authority under the Communications Act to completely deregulate Internet traffic, and they did that. Last September, They deregulated the phone companies. They had previously deregulated the cable company. That had been the object of the fight that went before the Supreme Court. So now we're living in a world where, for the first time, your broadband provider can pick and choose what traffic is going to get priority. And if you're trying to do a voice over IP service that competes with the phone or cable company, maybe your packets won't travel at the right speed and you'll have a lot of problems. Or the big issue that people are talking about now is, well, maybe I, as a content provider, pretend I'm Disney, I'll pay AT&T to download my video content really, really fast so that all of my competitors for the video space in broadband, which is becoming much more exciting for a lot of these providers, that I'll be at the head of the line and everybody else will be a lot slower, so people will want to come to my site. Congress is considering different laws to address that. Some of them say there's one very good one that's been put out there by Senator Wyden of Delaware that is absolutely the phone companies can't do that, and it's got some real teeth to prevent the phone or cable companies from discriminating against, as we call it, the traffic from any site, and that making them treat all the traffic equally. There are other versions out there that are kind of just aspirational. You know, you shouldn't block or do bad things, but don't really have a lot of teeth. And there are some folks in Congress who think, well, heck no, why shouldn't private companies be able to block traffic or cut these deals or do whatever they want? So this is a very live issue. And it's one that everybody should really be concerned about, and particularly for these community broadband projects, this is a real problem, because while you can get good traffic within the cloud or within your community, if you set it up right, if you try to go outside that to the bigger internet, somebody has to carry your traffic, and what you end up being potentially are these islands in the stream, as it were, where, you know, trying to push upstream with a major carrier to carry my traffic to the broader internet is where I'll run into all of these problems, and I won't be able to get the kind of content that I want or have people read my content. You know, if I'm trying to be a business in a small town which has a municipal broadband system.
Harold Fell, let me stop you for a second, because we've only got about 10 minutes left, and I've got three callers who've been patiently waiting. But quickly, for people who want to follow this net neutrality issue, who want to be involved, want to make sure Congress does the right thing, what website can they go to? How can they stay on top of this issue?
Well, Free Press has a good website on this.
That's at freepress.net.
Right, and both Sasha and I have personal blogs where we try to maintain information about this.
Okay, and so if they go to the respective websites, we give them mediaaccess.org.
And mine would be sashameinrath.com.
Sashameinrath.com. Boy, I hope people are writing all this down.
And my personal website is actually at wetmachine.com.
Wetmachine.com. Okay, that's a good title.
But I do really briefly want to tie this all together, and that is that when we're talking about these applications, the caller before that was mentioning using voice over IP, his phone service is through the internet. What these companies are trying to do is take a free medium, as in like anyone can access anything on the internet, and create an artificial scarcity.
There's no economic or technological justification for this.
Right.
It's just using monopoly power to
exactly
shake
so that
down.
They can extract more money out of your pocketbook.
Yeah. Okay, on that clarification, let's go back to the phone lines, and I'm going to have to ask the callers to be very brief if we can, because we've got a lot to talk about and not much time. Line 4, Crystal Lake, thank you for your patience.
Yeah, I understand that the government should retain control of the analog system. They gave the businesses, the cable companies and TV, the dial digital, and that's supposed to be in 2006, deferred, I guess, for another 2 years later. But what you're talking about is community internet, and to get that means government should retain the analog so that we could keep the community internet instead of Verizon giving it to the cable companies and TV. I think it's this bulk frequency that's so very clear and good for the would be free, as you say. And the you said the broadband is a connection of internets. I know the SBC controls a lot of the phone internet. And the other companies, the phone companies, have to tie in with that, go through the SBC. So this is mainly a problem that Congress will decide, isn't it? I mean, our local cities won't decide all this, but you mentioned the community should get this unlicensed spectrum.
Yes, thank you very much, Aaron. We don't have much time left, so let's throw this, if we can, before our experts. But, Sasha, even before you interject, let me just sort of recast this a little bit. There was a huge merger announced a couple of weeks ago between AT&T and SBC. They've already got the ads all over television announcing it as a fait accompli, setting up this massive national and global superpower in telecommunications. I think the point that the caller was getting at that we sort of haven't said directly here is that the networks we're talking about, these internet networks, in very short order are going to encompass the entirety of electronic communication and even non-electronic, because newspapers will increasingly come over them as well. I mean, we're talking about television services. We're talking about telephone. I mean, this is really what's at stake here. This isn't just about getting fast email.
Yeah, I mean, it's an uber medium that encompasses every other one that we transmit today. And because of that, like, if you look at our licensure regime, you know, that dates back to the technologies of the 30s, even the late 20s, and we haven't really updated that to take advantage of things like computers or digital technologies. And so what the caller has brought up an amazingly important point, which is that television is being transformed. They're moving the spectrum, and thus a lot of new spectrum is coming up. And unfortunately, instead of saying,
spectrum is the word for airwaves, that the wireless signals, TV, radio, cell phone, and wireless internet get communicated through.
Exactly. And they can be used either for single purpose, which is the vast majority of all of the electromagnetic spectrum.
Like AM 580, we're the only station on that in this area.
Right. Or you can do more innovative things, like do multiple carriers on a single frequency, a high power and a low power one, or open up some to unlicensed devices. When you look at community internet globally, it exists in this tiny little slice of the spectrum, and yet huge amounts of data are moving through that. But what's important is that the FCC hasn't moved on this. In fact, it's helped prevent innovation in this realm. And now there's two bills at the Senate level that have been introduced just in the last month or so that look to open up the vacated analog television broadcast spectrum to more innovative uses like unlicensed devices. And so one of the things that Harold and I spend a lot of time on right now is trying to move that agenda forward to basically allow the general public more access to our own airwaves. And those on the other side are, you know, the people that own or have licenses, exclusive licenses, because they're afraid that if you had diversity, they might lose out on market share.
Yeah, their monopoly power is undercut. I think it's a no-brainer.
Yeah, and I just want to add one last thing, which is there are opportunities to be involved in this at every level, and depending on how much time you have, at the local level, at the state level, at the federal level, there are a lot of organizations that are involved in this issue. The way that these companies win is by convincing people that this is too hard, this is too complicated, and they're just little people who don't have any strength against the big companies. As we've proved last year, when we had these fights in 14 different states and also in Congress, that when people find out about this and they're willing to make their feelings known and they are willing to take a stand and put some time into this, we can send the big guys running with their tails between their legs. And that's just, democracy really does work, but it takes a heck of a lot of effort to move it.
You're listening to Harold Feld, the Senior Vice President of Media Access Project. In the studio also, who you just heard before, Harold, is Sasha Meinrath, the Project Co-Coordinator of Champaign-Urbana Community Wireless Network. They are both going to be connected with the National Summit for Community Wireless Networks coming up just next weekend, March 31st to April 2nd. in St. Charles, Missouri, just outside of St. Louis at Lindenwood University. Please attend it if you're interested in the issues we're talking about. It's going to be really everyone from around the country working on these issues. I'm going to be there, Jim Snyder, lots of folks, and you don't have to be an expert to be there. And again, the website, Sasha, for people to learn more.
Is wirelesssummit.org.
Wirelesssummit.org. We have a couple of very patient callers who I want to get to, if we can, before we leave the air. Line one, Geneva, thank you for your patience.
Yeah, hello. I tuned in late. You may have mentioned this earlier, but Geneva and St. Charles and Batavia tried to have Internet access as a utility about a year ago, and I think it just disappeared. Is there any city in Illinois that does have it as a utility?
All right. Thank you, caller.
Right. Well, it didn't just disappear. You had over $300,000 spent by the telecom incumbents to prevent that from actually taking place. There are a number of cities and towns in Illinois that are looking actively at both wireless and wireline networks. I'd be happy off air to go through a bunch of those with
you. I think if they go to the freepress.net website, there's a map where they can click on Illinois and it'll list all the communities that have them and information about them.
Yeah, absolutely. We recently had a wireless roundtable up in Itasca, Illinois, up near Chicago, and we'd expected about 20 different people. We got over double that because there's such a move in Illinois right now to do this.
Let me make one point for our final caller, which is, I mean, the idea that these companies are sort of free market entrepreneurial companies has really got to be questioned. These are companies that are built on government monopoly licenses that built up their whole empires on granted monopoly licenses.
Right. And if you want to see something or read something that'll really boil your blood, there's a guy, Bruce Kushnick, who wrote a book called The $200 Billion Broadband Scandal, where he talks about we've already paid as taxpayers. We've provided $200 billion in tax breaks to provide 45 megabit symmetric lines to our households. This is the equivalent of $2,000 per household that we've already paid.
Yeah, this isn't a free market. This is all subsidies and monopolies. So let's go to the final caller if we can. Line 2, Slaterville Springs, New York. You're on the air.
Hi. My small rural community could really benefit from a high-speed wireless network access, and I'm wondering what is the smallest scale and maybe number of users that is economically feasible for us to be able to effectively negotiate with some access provider?
And also, Sasha, as you're answering that, what's the shortest answer you can give to that, Nara?
Two people, yeah. I mean, if you share a line, so two people are using one line, you're going to see huge cost savings right off the bat. And if you think that's crazy, think about every internet cafe, right? You go down to your local internet cafe, there's 20, 30 people all using the same exact Ethernet line. And this is possible between two neighbors, between a couple of people in an apartment building, amongst a couple of houses on a block, or over an entire metropolitan area.
Harold Feld, we're down to the last 30 seconds or so. Any closing comments on where we're at right now and what the road ahead looks like?
Well, I think, you know, on the one hand, we have a lot of momentum in favor of these community systems. A lot of people are very interested in it. There are some out there that show it really works. In the states where there have been bad laws passed, like Pennsylvania and Louisiana, there are now efforts to get those reversed. So in one year, things have really turned around. At the other end of it, there's still a lot to do on the deregulation of the big broadband providers, the net neutrality issues we've talked about, the wireless issues. And at the end of the day, what's going to make a difference is whether people think this is important enough.
On that note, Harold Feld, I want to thank you so much for joining us, taking time out of your Sunday. Sasha Monrath, thank you, too.
Thank you, Bob.
I'm Bob McChesney. See you in 167 hours with Matt Rothschild.